So good afternoon or good morning. And this is October 10th, 2009. And this teleconference is on, well, it's on the lower self, really. And what I did was I'm going to be doing some presentations on the Patrick book, The Undefended Self, which was written by Susan Basenga. And what her book does is she brings a lot of different concepts together and creates a synergy of these concepts, which are really useful for teaching, and they're a refreshing way to look at some of the material. So you don't have to have the book to understand the teleconference, because it refers to several lectures, but you will have to have some knowledge of three or four lectures or look them up later. On the website, I have mounted a worksheet that has three pages of notes from The Undefended Self, and also some quotes from Lecture 14, which is Higher Self, Lower Self, and Mask, and also Lecture 134, The Concept of Evil, and a worksheet and a few other things. So the material is there on the web. You can download it in PDF format. What I did for this teleconference was I made an outline based on the chapter, and I just listed the subheadings that Susan made and thought that I would march through them and add to and, you know, go back and forth with them. If you have any questions while I'm talking, please feel free to go ahead and speak up. I'm happy to have your questions. In fact, I enjoy them. It gives me, number one, an idea what you might be thinking or what perceptions you might be having of the material. And secondly, it also can take us in some interesting directions. So I encourage you to consider that your questions could be relevant not only for you, but for others who are listening in. It's a wonderful quality of universality in this kind of material. So let's begin. The title of the chapter is called Facing the Lower Self. And the first point that she makes is that facing the lower self is, in effect, an act of the higher self. That being willing to confront what is distorted or not working or negative within yourself is a major turning point in spiritual work. Because the deepest work that you will be able to do will be the work on yourself, on your spiritual path, on your spiritual principles and values, and on how you act and react with the real world. This is, to some extent, the only true control that we have. All other control is illusory because it depends on the cooperation of other people, or even the cooperation of gravity, or the cooperation of timing and circumstance, or many, many other aspects. But the one thing that we can control absolutely, unequivocally, is our attitude towards what happens at any given moment. So in the act of turning around and facing the parts of us that aren't up to snuff, that aren't as enlightened as we would like them to be, and parts of us that simply enjoy negativity, in facing up to that part of us, what we are saying is, I will be willing to look at all. I will be willing to look at everything. And the phrase that Susan uses in this book a few times is to embrace. Now, that may be confusing for some people. The term embrace does not mean accept, although there needs to be acceptance of what is. It doesn't mean that you approve of or like or enjoy what you see or what you are. But there is a quality of saying yes to it for what it is in that moment. It is the equivalent, you might consider. I have a technical problem. Let me fix this. about that. I have a camera that seems to want to turn off after 4 minutes sometimes. No matter how delicately or wonderfully I press the button, it simply says, nope, 4 minutes later I will turn off. So it's back on. So in terms of embracing your lower self, this is not an acceptance in the sense of, I love you, I want you just the way you are, but rather an acceptance that that is the way we are. So in embracing your lower self, embracing the entirety of who you are, it allows you to have a willingness to look, and it is the willingness to look that creates an awareness. So the joke is, without awareness, you can't see anything. So no matter what your intentions are, no matter how good your intentions are, if you do the equivalent of walking along with your eyes closed, you're going to have limited perception and limited ability to see what's going on, to interact appropriately, and to address things that aren't going well. And by opening our eyes, sometimes it is quite true that we see things that upset us or distress us, that we wish were not there. We may feel shame about it, and we may feel despair about it. But still, it's important to have our eyes open to be able to see what is before we have any chance whatsoever of transforming what is. So in the lower self, we are changing the dynamic from simply, in lecture 127, the phrase is automatic reflex. And what's referred to there is that for a period of time, we simply live life. And we're not going through self-examination. We're not looking inward as much. We're simply dealing with what comes at us. And then there comes a time where we slow down and we start asking questions and we start wondering what else is possible. And it is at this point that we go, based on lecture 127, from automatic reflex into awareness. Now, awareness does not solve things, but it is the next step, and for the understanding, which is step three in lecture 127, for understanding to begin, you need to see what's out there, what's happening, what's going on. And then step four of that lecture is a knowing, an inner acceptance and sense that you are comfortable with what is and ready to go on again. So facing the lower self being a major turning point in how we approach life. So what is the lower self? Like Susan's explanation, in that she describes the lower self as the creative center of negativity. Consider that. The creative center of negativity. So there is negativity, but our lower self is where we work with it, where we enact it, where we are attracted to it, where we play with it. And the important thing to remember in that is creative center. So another point that she makes is that energy is like yin-yang. There is no bad energy, good energy. Energy just is. Energy can be used for negative purposes. Negative can also be used for positive purposes. So the lower self is a place where there's a congealing, there's a density of negative energy that is turning around and active and doing things. And so if you think of it like that, the transformation of the lower self becomes a matter of releasing that energy, of dissipating the negativity, releasing the energy, so that it can be used for other purposes. So the second thing that our lower self is a defense against pain. So I'll go into a moment about how the lower self begins to activate in human beings. But basically, the lower self is a defense against pain. It may be real pain, or it may be imagined pain. It may be that we think something hurts, or we're afraid that it will hurt. And so we put up our defenses to prevent that from happening. Instead of, once again, using the word embrace, instead of reaching out and saying, yes, this is uncomfortable, this situation is uncomfortable, I don't like it, it upsets and frightens me, makes me nervous, but I still need to see what's here, I still need to explore it. That doesn't mean that I actively seek pain, but I don't necessarily automatically retract from it and do everything I can to avoid it. The lower self doesn't want to experience pain on any level for any reason. And so as a defense, it doesn't judge whether pain is a growing pain or a necessary pain or an unfortunate but temporary. It doesn't make those evaluations. The lower self simply says, pain bad, no pain good, and locks us into activities and attitudes where we will not experience more pain than we can possibly avoid. The third aspect of the lower self is that it is reaction. And in reaction, we are going into a sense of numbness. We are saying no to an experience. So keeping in mind that it's a creative center of negativity, it kind of knows that, and it is defended against pain. And one of the ways to defend against pain is to shut off feelings, so the lower self becomes numbness. It becomes reactionary in that it will not consider the value of something. It simply says good for me or bad for me, and it makes a judgment based on limited goals and vision, and negates anything that doesn't feel good or comfortable for it. So it's a reaction, and it acts out of numbness because to some degree it has shut off feeling as part of its defense against pain. That's what the lower self is. The distinction between lower self and soul is explained as evil being a splitting off of consciousness. So again, in a later point, I'll talk about some of the religious and karmic and stuff. But in terms of the splitting off of consciousness, the pathwork presents that life, human life, is a school. A school for learning and transformation. And that in this school, if you want to take that analogy just a little bit further, let's say we go through grades. Instead of incarnations or lifetimes, it's like we go through different classes and different experiences, moving up the evolutionary spiritual ladder so that we have more and more awareness, and we are transforming more and more of this closed off, numb, fearful attitude, and becoming more enlightened, more willing, allowing our heart to open. But evil goes back to the initial split. The cosmology of the guide parallels many of the, most of, the religions and philosophies, religious philosophies that humans have developed. And that is that there was some kind of initial separation from the divine. And in that separation, there's a no. Rather than an I want to explore, wouldn't this be interesting, let's all have fun together, there's a rejection of the divine that creates a split, that creates a separate type of consciousness. And this is the concept of evil that Pathwork works with. So what happens with the lower self in terms of human form is that we wind up interacting with evil, being attracted to it, allowing it in our lives, not taking care to keep it contained or away from us, because the split of evil, the split of consciousness, actually feels like there is less pain. In that separation from the divine, we cut off our sensitivity, become more separate, more alone, and yet more numb can feel like a positive. It can feel calmer, quieter, even safer to be separated from the divine, because the divine really represents an ongoing transformation, purification, and awareness. And awareness, one of the ways I explain this is when your arm or your leg goes numb, you have a moment where you realize that the limb has gone numb, and then you move it. And what has happened is there has been a slight pinch in the nerve or a decrease in blood to the limb. And because of that, the nerves in the limb have gone numb. They don't have enough oxygen and food to do their process. So they've gone numb. They have, in effect, shut down. And then you make a slight movement, and the blood comes rushing back, and the nerves wake up, and you get pins and needles. And the pins and needles can feel intense. It can almost make your eyes water. It feels so ferocious and terrible. What can you do? You can't stop it from enacting, and you can't turn it off. So we all kind of breathe deeply and wait for just a few moments for that intense sensation to subside. And then the arm or leg returns to normal. Imagine, if you would, if when we made that slight adjustment and those pins and needles started, we could shut it down again. Imagine if we said, that hurts. That's too intense. I can't bear that. I just can't stand it. I'm going to turn it off. Oh, that's much better. Your arm or leg would die. The tissues, after being cut off for X amount of time, would die, and the limb would become gangrenous. It would begin to rot. And eventually, if you didn't cut it off or have someone help you out, your whole organism would die because of this dead organ, this dead limb, that would then poison your system. And yet, when we do that on an emotional level, we do not see the consequences. There are consequences. One of the lectures that I'm going to teach later this year is 196, Commitment, Cause and Effect. And one of the things that lecture talks about is that when you separate cause and effect, when you have an effect that is so far away from the cause that you cannot see the connection between the two, you lose awareness of what's happening. In effect, you can no longer do anything about it because you don't know why something is happening. So emotionally, when you, for instance, feel lonely and afraid and you open your heart, you might have the feeling that is very, very similar to the pins and needles in your arm. You may feel overwhelmed. You may feel the intensity of your own loneliness. You may open your heart and find that your friends are delighted, and they say things like, where have you been? What have you been doing? We've called and we've tried to contact you, and it's loving and wonderful chatter, but sometimes it feels like a criticism, and we suddenly feel like we've done something wrong. But the overwhelm of suddenly being open again to input from other people and to our own feelings can feel so intense and so overwhelming that we once again shut it down. Imagine, if you would, a cycle of this where we keep shutting down any level of intense feelings having to do with reenacting or resuscitating friendships. After a while, people wander away. after a while, people decide you don't want to be friends. You show no interest, you never contact them. And so the stimulus goes away, and then of course you can open up and you won't feel that kind of intensity from the outside. And because there is no outside stimulus, you may not notice your own feelings. So you open up then and you say, ah, now I feel comfortable. Now I feel that I can open my heart. And yet you are opening your heart to a much more limited experience. So what I'm describing here is that just like the physical, we may have to learn to tolerate. We may have to learn to bear with, grit our teeth and just get through it on intense emotional experiences, just like we let our arms and our legs wake up. Because by turning away that intense experience, we do not re-enliven, we do not re-engage, and we lose awareness of our feelings and of the situation. So what I'm describing here is that evil, in the Patrick understanding, evil is a separation where you have managed to cut off the interaction. And you may have been able to cut off the feeling so that you are isolated and alone. There's a chilly, cold quality to that, which has truth in it, because evil tends to want things under control and slow, and that's not real. So evil is creating an artificial environment where it can control everything and shut down outside input and shut down any internal feelings that want to come forward that it doesn't feel comfortable with. So it is this quality of separation and falseness that the Pathwork concept of evil works with. So you have the lower self, which is a creative center of trying to enact this. How do I separate? How do I shut down this feelings? How do I avoid? It's a very creative and active center. But then you have the underlying principle of evil, which is I don't want to play. I don't want to love. I don't want to be with other people. I don't want to give up any control. I want it all for myself. But the quality of evil is very cold and deliberate, and the lower self is more of a of an alive, once again, creative center. So we're talking about the difference, a bit of difference between the lower self and evil. Then there's an element or a section on the denial of the lower self. And these aren't necessarily logical, it's just a flow of information. In the denial of the lower self, basically what we say, when I described evil, and I said evil shuts off all the input so that it can be in the illusion that that doesn't exist or matter. In the denial of the lower self, in the refusal to look at our negativity, in the refusal to see where we are stubborn or resistant or selfish, that is a form of separation. So the denial of the lower self, the refusal to see it, is a form of evil. Now, human beings deny a lot of things. One of the things that Susan analogizes this to is the fear of death. So it's a great analogy, it's a common analogy, that we may deny, for instance, that we have an illness because we simply cannot face our own mortality. We don't want to believe that life is going to be over very, very soon. We don't want to believe that we're going to have to undergo a certain kind of experience. So we simply say it's not there. Now, that doesn't change the illness. And since life is mortal, since we're all terminally, we're all terminal with life, it works the same way on a very, very long, long road. That's, my words are not elegant this evening. Denial of an illness is just a shorter, simpler version of the denial of our ultimate death. It's easy to avoid death when you've got 90 years to work with, because that's a long time period. When that time period is shortened and a doctor tells you you have 3 months, once again, it intensifies the whole experience. And because we really don't wake up in the morning saying this is the first day of the rest of my life, and this is one, I have just lost one day and I have one less day to live, we don't live like that. When we are told that we have an illness that is going to terminate our life early, it feels healthier and as if we would be healthier and happier if we just say that doesn't exist and we just kept living our life the way it was going before that. Now, it doesn't change the illness. It just means that we don't deal with it. So while it may be true that you go along for a period of time and you're relatively speaking happy, whereas if you faced a disease, you might be miserable and upset, you also may not have the opportunity to end your life the way you wish. In effect, it's like getting zapped one day. You're going along and your life ends abruptly. If you know that your life is going to end in a matter of months, you actually have a special opportunity to live those few months in a very, very special and extra aware way so that you get as much life as possible into those 3 months. So what I'm presenting here is that the denial of the lower self is just like denying that we have an illness. It won't stop the illness. It is possible that the illness could get worse or accelerate. It's not going to necessarily just go away. Denying the lower self does not mean it goes away. It doesn't heal. It doesn't transform. And because we're not aware of it, we are losing connection to cause and effect. So if we deny our lower self, which is the cause of things, and then we act out negatively, but we have denied the cause, then we may not know why we act out in a certain way. And because we don't understand why, we can't track it back and we cannot deal with it. So the denial of the lower self is equivalent to the denial of death. It won't change anything, and it breaks the chain between cause and effect. Now, there are three particular aspects of the lower self, and they are set out in the lecture 30, which is the pride, self-will, and fear. And when you study the lectures, it's a lot of material, it's a lot of words, so we tend to try to comb through all this stuff by making charts and graphs and saying, okay, what 3 points are we talking about? And making matrices and tables and charts. And the guide talks a lot in threes, which perhaps is a human thing. I don't know why three is so prevalent. So the defenses of pride, self-will, and fear are match up to the personality types of reason, will, and emotion, which is lecture 43. And the reason I'm mentioning so many lectures in this presentation is this is a synthesis of a lot of information, a way of, if you've read 10 different lectures, of bringing all those lectures together and seeing things a bit differently based on all the concepts rather than looking at one single concept at a time. That's why I thought I would change the way I was doing things and work with this kind of synthesis, partly to liven it up and partly because we have been talking about these individual lectures and I'm trying to bring them into a larger context. So the personality defenses of pride, self-will, and fear are the lower self aspects, personality types. And pride, why is pride a defense? Because pride is how we say, I don't have to look at that. It is beneath me to think that I would do such a thing. I am better than that. Pride says, I am better than others. So I should not have to do the kind of work other people do. I'll take care of it by myself. I shouldn't have to go to classes. I shouldn't have to take personal sessions. I should look at myself. And especially if we have a superficiality to our life that is basically in good shape. It's a justification. We must be doing something right because, you see, we have a good job and we have finances and we have friends and we have a relationship. What's there to look at? That may have truth in it. But what I'm talking about is when we say that out of pride, out of a sense of superiority meant specifically to prevent self-analysis, to stop examination, rather than consciously and intelligently say, I don't think I need to worry about that particular aspect at this particular time. That might be self-analysis. But pride simply takes a huge brush and says, I'm better than that. I shouldn't have to do that. I don't have that problem. It's different from coming to that conclusion after self-examination. The quote from Lecture 30 is that he who feels the humiliation of another person less than his own has such pride. Let me repeat that. He who feels the humiliation of another person less than his own still has too much pride. That is the kind of pride I'm talking about. In real empathy, when you see someone humiliated or shamed, your heart might go out to them, and you might find that there's places in you that understand how that feels, and you would empathize with that other human being needing or having to feel those feelings. But when you see someone's humiliation and you do not access those feelings in you, that's due to pride. We don't want to feel those feelings. We want to pretend that we are not the kind of person that has been humiliated or needs to be humiliated. And this is where pride is what makes us laugh and point at other people. Look at him. Oh, isn't he stupid? Isn't he funny? Who would say that if they could remember in their own heart what it feels like? Humiliated. So this is what the guide means. Basically what he's saying is that you need to feel the other person's pain, humiliation, whatever it is, as much as you would feel your own. That is when your heart is open. And to not feel that is an indication of pride. So the antidotes to pride are honest self-confrontation and humble self-acceptance, out of which real self-esteem comes. So like every other element, pride in and of itself is not a bad thing. It just is. You can have pride about an appropriate event or an appropriate action. But when pride is intended to separate you or prevent you from feeling feelings that you find uncomfortable, that's when pride has become a defense. So with pride, self-will, and fear, the next one is self-will. And self-will is not free will. Free will is the ability to choose. When we are in self-will, we actually lose the ability to choose because self-will has already taken a side. Self-will has decided what's good for me is what I'm going to put energy into, vote for, be with, fight for, say or do. Self-will has already chosen me over you. So self-will is a defense that says, I want everything my way. Then I won't be upset. Then I won't have feelings of fear. I won't hate you if I have everything I need. Well, having everything you need or not having everything you need shouldn't necessarily result in hatred of another. So having everything you need is a defense against feeling the possibility that you may have hatred regardless. So to prevent your feeling of hatred, you accumulate things around you so that you feel comfortable and happy. And then you feel like you don't feel hatred. But the reality is the hatred's still there. It is simply not activated. And this is an example of how we deny the lower self, by simply doing whatever it takes so that it's not disturbed or activated. That's not transforming the thing. That is, in effect, pacifying it. One of the phrases I use is feeding the lions. So if you have a lion who's hungry and your solution is to feed the lion, that's fine as long as you've got a basket of steaks. But the day is going to come when you run out of food to feed the lion. And so if you have not dealt with the possibility that the lion could be hungry and there's nothing left but you to eat, the chances are that at that point you will have no other option but to be eaten by the lion. There's a place where you may want to feed the lion for a while you figure out other options. You find a cage, you find a lion tamer, you do whatever it is you have to do. But to feed the lion without having an alternative plan, without thinking things through, without considering what happens when you run out of steak, that's what happens when you pacify and do not activate the lower self without actually dealing with it. One day, you're not going to be able to have everything you need, to have all the control you think you have to do. And in that moment, you will become activated, and your lower self will erupt without necessarily having any opportunity on your part for, you haven't planned for this, you haven't made any arrangements, and you haven't started the work of a self-analysis. So when lower self erupts and reaches out and roars like a lion, it could act out negatively. And you may be very, very surprised by the feelings that may come out of you, because you haven't really addressed them, you're not aware of them, and you haven't dealt with them. So back to self-will. So self-will says, I want what I want when I want it. And self-will occurs when free will is used in the service of the little ego. So in other words, when I use my free will only in service of me as an individual, that's a very small version of me. What all spiritual paths teach is that there is a greater me, a greater us, a greater you. And that enlightenment, part of enlightenment, is about seeing the other person's needs and realizing that sometimes we need to give way on our needs to meet their needs, because they are us. And in that larger sphere, and I've spoken of the three spheres of consciousness before, in that larger sphere of us, when you have what you need, I do have more happiness. And the planet has more happiness. But when I only take care of me, the chances are that I may be neglecting you or overlooking you, or somebody's going to get neglected and overlooked, because I'm certainly not looking after them. And so when I only take care of me, and then someone is left out, and they become activated, and they act out negatively, then to some degree, I bear some responsibility for that. I created a situation where someone was ignored. I ignored them. Now, I'm not talking about a situation where you have no authority or no power and you can't help what's going on in the world. I'm talking about an attitude of seeing the needs of others and considering that perhaps your needs need to be adjusted so that all of us can have a bit more joy, a bit more happiness. There's a lot of noise. If somebody could hit star 6 and silence their phone, please. To some extent, that's what taxation is about. In almost any government, taxation takes a little bit from everyone and puts it in a pool and tries to make sure that the community's needs are met. And sometimes that means that an individual gets some help, and sometimes that just means that the community is taken care of in ways that an individual might not notice if they were only looking after themselves and their family. So in a community, there are needs that are very subtle and get forgotten. But by pooling resources and having somebody in charge of taking care of the greater need, we are all better off. So I'm describing where self-will is selfish, where it is, it hasn't got any foresight, it doesn't plan, it doesn't see ahead, it doesn't look at the other, and therefore, to some degree, it is actually acting against its own interests by being selfish. So this is a defense, and it is designed to give me everything I want when I want it without any regard at all for you and your needs, or a lesser regard for you and your needs. And in that way, I defend against my feelings of not having enough, and I also deactivate or keep unactivated my lower self, which might be angry and grab something from you. Now, I haven't healed that. I haven't addressed it. But it's not active because I've been somewhat selfish and taken care of myself first. That's why we speak of it as a defense. Last defense is actually underneath the other two. And the last defense is fear. And fear is what says there might not be enough. Fear says if we feel those feelings of empathy with the person being humiliated, we will feel destroyed and we will feel feelings that we can't handle. And so let's not do that. There is a fear of experiencing feelings that drive us to numb ourselves and block off those feelings. Rather than being willing to feel them, just go ahead and feel them and see how it goes. And finding out that it will not destroy you, it may make you uncomfortable. And it may bring up some things that you want to look at, but it will not kill you to experience something. Now that's where fear, I like using biology with concepts because it helps ground me. It helps me feel that I understand the concept when it's concrete and it talks about something specific. So in the lecture on the defense, which is 101, the guide talks about defense being a result of an overuse of adrenaline because we have mistakenly presumed that our lives are in danger. Now, on a physical level, when our lives are in danger, the adrenaline pumps into our bloodstream and heightens our senses and gives us extra energy and allows us to do amazing things because our lives are at stake and we must do something about it. But humans aren't simply their biology. Human beings also use the biology of their being as a construct in their mind. And so a human being will say, my social life is in danger if I misbehave. And your mind will translate that into life or death. Your mind will translate a bit of humiliation into the threat of annihilation on a social level. And so what happens is we take the biology of our being, we translate it into the mental aspect of our being, and we invent stuff. So at that point, fear is ungrounded. Fear isn't rooted in death or life. It's not rooted in starvation versus survival. it becomes more and more subtle, and the definition of dying versus living turns into making a faux pas at the dinner table instead of falling over a cliff. So our reaction to making a small social error becomes gigantic. We're actually using our biology, and we will pump adrenaline through us. We will imagine that we are in absolute danger making some small social mistake. And we will pump up our body and become more active and become more aware, and the adrenaline will course through us. We'll actually get a little bit nervous and shaky. This is because our mind is generating life or death scenarios over concepts. So that's why fear becomes a defense instead of a life-affirming tool. So where fear might save the animal from being eaten, what it does for us as human beings is we imagine a fear, and we do whatever it takes to make the fear go away. The problem is the fear may not be real. So in service of the lower self, the fear would say, I don't want to feel those feelings. I don't want to feel uncomfortable. It makes me nervous. It makes me upset. Shut that down. And it can treat that situation as if it's a lion or a tiger, so that it says, get away, go away, shut the door, quit the job, cut off the relationship, don't go outside, stay inside, don't expose yourself, stay hidden, don't give to the other, because then you might feel these feelings of being bereft, of not having, and you might act out negatively, and that would get you disliked. So don't give. Hold on to things. Then these feelings will not be activated. But what is speaking there is fear. It's a special kind of fear because it's not grounded in reality. We have control of it in our minds, and we allow it free rein to tell us whatever we want to hear. Let me go back to what I said in the beginning, and that is the only thing that you have total and complete control of is your attitude. In this example of fear, if you decide that you will simply not be afraid of losing your job, I've been in that situation a couple of times where I have felt that I didn't really want the job in the first place. And sometimes I felt that way because they can't afford to fire me. So I can do almost anything I want, and I'm so crucial, and they have nothing to replace me with, so they're going to let me do. I'd have no fear of getting fired. On the other hand, if I was going to get fired in other situations, I didn't care. Either way, I can use this lack of fear about losing a job to either slack off and do what I please, or move through projects that might ordinarily wind up in discussion and committees and management decisions. But if I have the courage to say, no, this is the right thing to do, and I'm going to push it through, I'm going to do it, that ability to move with courage can actually come from the fact that I have decided I am not afraid. And the decision not to be afraid is an individual judgment. When I decide I can be fired, when I decide I can lose my job or lose my home or walk away from a relationship, I have decided that I will not be annihilated by that. And the fact that I'm broke, the fact that I don't have money, the fact that I would be lonely, the fact that I would have to make other major changes in my life, it's a choice on my part whether I decide to be afraid of that or not. So what I'm building here is that fear is actually a choice, unless you have a very simplistic, fundamental situation facing you. To be afraid of something is a choice. And because it is a choice, we do misuse it. And we decide to be afraid of change. We decide to be afraid of awareness. we decide to be afraid of growth and transformation. And we allow fear to flood us, and then we justify what we do based on, but I'm afraid, not realizing that we have chosen to be afraid. I'm going to go ahead and change the tape, and then we'll start part two. So if you'll bear with me for a moment.